from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll take a stroll along with the Indianapolis Garden Walk.
Then we'll hear the complete interview I did with musician Stuart Copeland, formerly of the Police, from when he was in town last month.
And I'll talk with Kirk Trevor of the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra about his nearly 30-year tenure there. Plus, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Indianapolis Gardening Club is celebrating its 20th anniversary garden walk on June 3rd with five fantastic gardens. Sharon Gamble invited Garden Walk co-chair Gretchen Witt in to learn more about the club and its highest profile event.
So before we get into the specifics of the garden walk, this year's garden walk, tell me how you got involved in Indianapolis Garden Club.
Well, my mother was an Indianapolis Garden member, and we both love to garden, and I saw how much she enjoyed the Indianapolis Garden Club, and so I was fortunate enough to be part of it.
So I have to ask the nature versus nurture question. Do you think you got chromosomes, or did she give you projects to do in the yard as you were growing up?
I think I just got lucky learning from her, and I'm still learning. So
I haven't met 100-year-old gardener who didn't say she was still learning.
That's right. That's right. The love of labor.
Yeah, exactly. Doctors bury their mistakes. Gardeners live with them, right?
That's right. That's right.
What is your personal specialty? What do you like as a gardener? You a perennial person, a rose? You like roses? You like trees?
Perennials for the most part. Yeah.
So for Indianapolis Garden Club, this is one of your biggest events, and this has been going on for a number of years, right?
Yes, this is actually our 20th annual garden
walk. Hey, congratulations.
Thank you.
You're not old enough to have been there when it was created, but do you know the story of how the garden walk got started?
You know, I think it just started out very small, and it just kind of has grown with popularity, and we're up to 600 visitors now. But
wow.
Initially we just had a couple gardens, but started out small, and we just kind of continued to grow.
Now, is there a theme to this year's gardens?
Actually, every garden has its own theme, and so it remains the same. We have five gardens that people are invited to see around Indianapolis.
And I know you don't reveal the addresses until, if you buy tickets, obviously you're going to get the addresses because you're going to drive yourself there. But can you tell us about some of the gardens that will be on this
year?
Sure.
We have five gardens. We have two in Meridian Hills, and we have three that are on the east of Binford Boulevard. And one of them is along White River, and another one is a fabulous one-acre garden.
One acre. Oh, that's ambitious.
Yeah, it really is. She is a accomplished painter and metal sculptor, and she purchased this house in the 90s and just kind of fell upon wanting to kind of get rid of the growth of the insidious plants, honeysuckle and things like that. Oh. And she just decided, you know, I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm going to tackle this. And she didn't really have any preconceived idea of what she wanted to do, but it's just a lovely place to visit. She meditates there, and I'm just thrilled for people to see it. She's just done so much with it. It's just wonderful. And that is what we call the Tranquil Garden Tapestry. It's just a beautiful place to see. She's added 400 tons of stone and 250 trees and just beautiful perennials. She's primarily stuck to perennials as the mainstay, just based on the lack of sun that she has there. Mm-hmm. But it's just, she just loves it every season, and she continues to tweak it and rework it and find new ideas. But I'm very happy that she's included.
And that's an inspiring story, too, to take something on that it sounds like maybe the previous owner was not particularly a gardener or...
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
And just battling that honeysuckle and getting that out is quite an accomplishment.
Yeah, and what we love to do is we love to pick a garden that is really done by that gardener.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I find very fascinating, mm-hmm. is that, you know, in this particular case, she had no really preconceived idea or landscaper telling her what to do. And she just, over time, has developed this beautiful, beautiful garden.
That's
so
inspiring.
We also have lovely gardens along the White River off Spring Mill that I think everyone will enjoy. There are two other gardens that kind of are what we consider the hilltop retreat. You'll be on a terrace overlooking a beautiful lawn and gardens. And then another one that we have, we kind of think is a kind of an English formal garden.
Oh.
She has a beautiful pool and other landscaping. So I think it's a nice mixture for this year.
Sure. So, a variety of styles.
Yeah.
Do you have a personal favorite?
I'm not going to say.
You're not allowed.
We've been so fortunate. It's been 20 years since we've had the Garden Walk, and we've had over 100 gardens over the 20 years, and it's really thanks to our garden owners that take on that task of inviting all of Indianapolis to come see their gardens. And we're just so very thankful for them and, of course, our sponsors. And we do this because we want to contribute to various horticultural projects throughout Indianapolis.
Yeah, let's talk about that. I know some of the beneficiaries of the proceeds include the Sky Garden at Eskenazi Health.
And, that's correct.
The cultural trail that folks have probably walked or bicycled on downtown,
mm-hmm.
The Indianapolis Museum of Art and the Marion County Public Library.
That's right, yeah. We have many projects. We have FarmWorks, Indy, also the Holiday Park project that's also involved this year. President Benjamin Harrison, their home in the gardens.
Mm-hmm.
So we're really happy to, participate in all that.
Mm-hmm. Now, are the gardens that are part of the Garden Walk, are the tenders of those gardens members of Indianapolis Garden Club or not necessarily?
Not necessarily. Sometimes yes and sometimes no.
Okay.
It helps to have backups. We had one year, the Garden Walk happens rain or shine.
Ah.
And we had one year where we had torrential rains and we had two members that stepped in to host two of the gardens. So thank goodness they did that because it would have been a very short walk.
So. Garden hop.
Yeah, that's right. Garden hop.
These are when our listeners choose to go on these tours, there's not a prescribed order, right? They just drive themselves to whatever the first garden they care to see is, and they're not assigned.
Mm-hmm. Their ticket will show the difference of locations.
Okay. And then have you ever had a problem where most of the guests went to the same first garden, or does it just somehow naturally work itself out?
It just naturally works out. And
that's
between
crazy.
Seeing gardens, you can also buy a lunch ticket to Woodstock Club. And so that breaks up some of the traffic also. So.
Oh, so you might see some gardens in the morning. What
Correct.
Are the hours?
9 to 3.
9 to 3. Oh, okay.
June 3rd.
Okay, so you could go see a couple or three of the gardens in the morning, then go have your luncheon. But you can buy a ticket just for the garden walk if you don't care to go to the luncheon. Right?
Correct. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
And do you know, you said you're up to about 600 guests regularly. Do you have a lot of repeat guests?
We sure do. We sure do. We keep a database of them, and they're very loyal. Last year, we had a lot of rain, but there's those loyal gardeners coming out there, rain or shine. So we just love them.
Do the garden hosts allow photography in their gardens?
You know, It depends.
Got it.
It depends on what they prefer. Mm-hmm. We have many volunteers at each location to answer any questions about certain plants that you may have. We have garden markers, but primarily we do what the owners would prefer.
Sure.
So.
But if the owners allow photography, sometimes an overcast day is better. So if we look at the forecast for June 3rd and say, oh, it's not necessarily a bad thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, it just depends.
So as we're having this conversation, you just finished with a different project. Tell me a little bit about how many projects does Indianapolis Garden Club do in a year, and what are some of the other projects that you do?
Well, our primary one is the Garden Walk.
Okay.
And then we just finished off a floral show at the IMA last Friday. It was open to the public on Saturday and Sunday. And that was something that we do about every 2 years, and we invite other organizations to exhibit there, and it just turned out to be wonderful time for all.
So given how early in the season that was, that wasn't necessarily just with flowers arranged from people's gardens, was it?
Well, you have floral design and horticultural specimens that are also judged.
Got it.
Primarily, and the theme was circus, and so it was quite challenging for me. For others, it was very simple, but it's lovely to see the creations. There's also photography at the floral show too. So I hope I mentioned all of them.
Yeah,
categories. So.
And this got, you know, it's always. When you go to a special event, if you've ever planned a special event, you really appreciate how much goes into it. What is your planning cycle? This probably, do you take a week off after 1 year and then start working on the next year's?
Or? Absolutely. You know, the location and coordinating the judges and the people that enter into the show. Mm-hmm. It's quite a production.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For people who'd like to become involved with Indianapolis Garden Club, what's your advice?
I would recommend that you check out our website, IGCGardenWalk.com, and learn more about our organization.
Sharon Gamble with Gretchen Witt, co-chair with Mary Grine of the Indianapolis Garden Club's 20th Annual Garden Walk. The event features 5 tour-at-your-own-pace gardens plus an optional luncheon at Woodstock Club. Funds raised benefit all kinds of public gardens throughout the city. For more information, visit IGCGardenWalk.com. Again, IGCGardenWalk.com.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
Drummer Stuart Copeland is perhaps best known for his work with the band The Police, though for most of his career he's also been writing for orchestras and writing soundtracks for films. Last month he was in Indianapolis for a concert at Clues Hall with pianist John Kimura Parker that featured many styles of music colliding in a performance they called Off the Charts. Travis DiNicola spoke with Copeland in our studios.
Stuart Copeland, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you here today.
Well, thank you for your kind hospitality.
Glad to. This is pretty cool. I've been looking forward to chatting with you and specifically about Off the Score, the concert that is going on at Clues Hall tonight. This is a really interesting event that you've put on with John Kimura Parker. And you guys have been doing this for a while. You've been working together for a while, right?
Well, no, this would be our 5th show.
Oh, wow.
We've been working on it for a while.
Yeah, okay.
But we've now finally ready for the stage because it's kind of persnickety. There's a lot of music in there, and the music is quite complex.
Mm-hmm.
And I get to do a lot of fun stuff on my drums. And the fact that I'm doing it a lot quieter in the classical environment means that I can do much cooler stuff than when I had to do everything at high volume.
Such as? How do you mean? I mean, using brushes, using just more subtle approaches?
Subtle approach, yeah.
Okay.
Because, you know, when you play with a rock band with heavy amplification,
yeah,
you pretty much, you know, on a volume, the only thing that works is anywhere from like 6 up to 11, you know, in terms of volume. Anything below that just doesn't read because of the clash. But in this music that we're playing here, because I've had quite, by now, 20 years of experience playing with orchestras where the instrument I have to play from 0 to 4.
Mm-hmm.
And if I get up to 5, the conductor gives me a look. If I get up to 6, the horns start to call their union guy, you know. And so I discovered through playing so quietly that all the technique that I worked so hard on as a kid now comes back into play.
It's paying
there
off.
There are all kinds of subtle little tricks and roughs and drags, and the drums sound better, and my hands feel better, and I don't have a splitting headache after 2 hours of high volume. It's just better all around.
And is it still as physical, though?
Oh, exactly. It is not. That's also very cool. I can now enjoy a full day's rehearsal and not change my T-shirt once. Rehearsing with a rock band, it is a physical labor. It's chopping wood for 2 hours on stage. And which I didn't mind because I was young and fresh, and that was what I was here for. And I wanted to go out there and slash and burn and louder, please. But then you grow up. But the music, when you take it to that point where a lot more technique is available, the music that we're playing, you know, Stravinsky, Ravel, Bach, calls for a lot more finesse. It's a lot more tricky to play. The time signatures, the meters are much more complicated. The changes are much more sophisticated. And so it's I'm kind of playing more because I'm playing less.
Do you use different
drums? Sounds
drum?
Like some kind of Eastern mysticism.
It does a little bit.
Because I've found in life that actually more is more.
More is more. Are you using different drums at all? Or I mean, you must use like one of those plexiglass sort of sound barriers, right? Or
actually, no. We have a plexiglass sound barrier around the piano. and that's to keep all the other stuff from going into the piano mics.
Okay, so
we can mic it up well. But no, I'm playing quiet enough so that you don't have to.
So you said... I mean, among, included in the concert, Stravinsky, Bach, Ravel, but it's not just the traditional interpretations of them. I mean, you're basically kind of going off on, it's almost like a jazz improvisation with starting with
classical. Don't use the jazz word.
No?
Just kidding. I was raised as a jazz musician, which means I'm pretty much immune to the stuff. And I have discovered in life that a good way to enliven a dinner party is to make an offhand comment such as, "The problem with jazz musicians is they all suck." And that immediately, what was once a dreary kind of conversation, suddenly everybody wakes up. Like, what? And I don't actually have any hard feelings about jazz at all. In fact, I love jazz fans because they're people who pay money to go out and watch musicians play every chop they've got, which is fun if you're that musician. So I love jazz fans. I enjoy dissing jazz because of the response that it gets, but actually I do have a grudging respect for it.
Fair enough. But improvisation is a big part of what you're doing in this concert.
But there's all kinds of improvisation that is not jazz. Fish, for instance. The whole jam band phenomena, we'd never describe that as jazz. What we do is we take the charts, and in classical times, cadenzas were intended to be improvised, although they were formalized by, Beethoven, among others, who would turn what was supposed to be an improvisation, they would write it down, and over time, those free-form moments became codified and are now the canon.
Okay.
And so it's been lost from classical music, although the intent was there from the original composers. Not so Stravinsky, but John Kimura Parker, who's one of the stellar pianists in America today.
Yes.
He's the guy they've parachuted in to play Rachmaninoff, you know, with the great orchestras across the land. And while he's playing these great works of art, he comes from that side of the great musical divide where they connect with music through the page, with their eyes, rather than a rock musician. They connect with their ears and instinct.
Connecting with the score.
Yeah, the classical players connect via the score, and their time is connected via the baton. It's a visual connection. And while he's playing these great works, he can hear possibilities, places where these progressions could go, with no disrespect to Uncle Igor, but there's other cool stuff that a modern musician, might be inspired by, but in his world, that would be anathema.
Sure.
You just don't do that. So the two of us came together to enable him to do that. And so we take this classical music and we mess with it. We have the main cool things that are there on the page, but then we go off the page and we extrapolate. And about half the material, by the way, is mine. Mm-hmm. Music that I've written for various classical environments.
Sure.
Actually, I use the word, we should be careful about the word classical, because
right.
I didn't die 200 years ago. Let's say orchestral.
Orchestral. Very good. Let's do that. But when you two are playing together, and also with the other musicians, you mentioned that more traditional classical orchestral music, there's a visual connection that's going on between the conductor and the musicians. When you two are playing, is there a visual connection? Is it all just in what you're hearing, or how does that work? How are you two playing off of each other?
Well, we have charts.
Mm-hmm.
I don't. I learned my parts, and that's mm-hmm. it. That's how I do.
Mm-hmm.
We have charts, but we go off them.
Okay.
And the great divide between, and this is where what's interesting about this ensemble, because, you know, Yun Kwan, first violin with the Met mm-hmm. in New York, you know, that's pretty fancy. Doesn't get much fancier than that. Young Marlon, our bass player, he's very young, but he is the next big thing.
Yeah, he's phenomenal.
I was turned on to him by Stanley Clark. He's the next big thing. And Judd Miller on this peculiar instrument called the EVI.
Yeah.
It kind of
looks like a long black shoebox or something.
Yes. I mean, he blows into that thing
uh-huh.
and generates these samples that he's created.
Okay.
And he's, you know, he's kind of, he has many arrows in his quiver. He is, he can read, you know, bat poop on the page. You know, you just throw ink at a page and he can read it.
Mm-hmm.
He is a great sound designer. He designs these sounds that he plays with on this instrument. But most of all, he's a fantastic musician.
Mm-hmm.
Take a solo, Judd, and he will just fly. And so those three things combine to make him a pretty unique component of this ensemble. And so we do rock out. We
yeah.
play with a lot of energy.
Mm-hmm.
But...
Yeah, I've listened to some samples, and it sounds like sometimes it's classical. Sometimes it sounds almost like a world beat. Other times it goes into a little bit more rock. I mean, it's kind of all over the place.
But there is one thing that holds it together, which is this feeling of tension between players.
Mm.
Judd, Marlon, and I, you know, the bass player, the EVI player, and mm-hmm. I, we understand improvising. But Yun Kwan on violin, she's mm-hmm. a classical musician, and John Kimura Parker, these classical guys, their whole ethos when they first become musicians is to adhere to the page, to look at the page, scrutinize what's on the page, and try and understand what the composer intended. And there's a very important reason for that, is that if you find yourself on stage with 90 players,
yeah.
you've all got to be on the same
sure.
page.
Sure, yeah, yeah. A little bit harder to improvise with 90
people.
And
so their
people,
whole
yeah.
ethos is respect for the page. They,
sure.
They, and that's what they do. And so when their hands play on their instrument, they're guided by visual information from the page.
Mm-hmm.
And their feel for the rhythm is guided by a visual cue from the conductor's baton. And so that's their whole thing. It's a visual connection to what their hands play. Rock musicians can play with their eyes closed.
Mm-hmm.
It's all connection with their ears and their instincts. And they just know when four bars are up. They don't, you know, a classical musician will navigate across the page from left to right, navigating every bar, every beat. And I have a rhythm going, dun, 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 you know.
Mm-hmm.
For a rock musician, just knows when that's going to get back to one. He doesn't need to count it. But a classical musician will navigate every bit, but, dot, dot, which looks like hell on the page because there's tied notes and, you know. But
yeah.
actually, it's just a dun, dun. It's just an even thing. And so these classical musicians, in concert with ear guys,
mm-hmm.
There's an interesting tension there.
What are your audiences like? Are you getting a mix of audiences who are coming there because they're, you know, Stuart Copeland fans? They're coming there because they
well,
think...
it is a mix.
Yeah.
A lot of the people are season ticket holders who come to hear Stravinsky and they go, oh, cool.
Yeah.
I never heard it like that before. And then the other half are people who are maybe rock fans
yeah.
who go, wow, Stravinsky. Cool.
Cool. Yeah. Plans to record on this or
well actually we're all camera enthusiasts
mm-hmm.
and we're a 7-camera shoot every
mm-hmm.
show
mm-hmm.
and it's kind of a fun thing that we do is that we shoot at these shows and then cut little movies which
yeah
are
there's
all
some great stuff on YouTube
yeah
yeah
they're all you know they're up there and that's making an album seems kind of irrelevant these days you know
mm-hmm.
we probably will be persuaded to put it onto a disc just
mm-hmm.
so that it's available in that way but it's really about the live concert. That's what we're here for, is to play the show.
Let me shift gears just a little bit. You've been, over the years, have done a lot of work with soundtracks. I still love the Rumblefish soundtrack, one of my favorite ever. When you're working on a movie like that, do you wait until the whole thing's done and cut, or are you a part of the process early on? I mean, because a lot of the movies I've seen that you have scored the soundtracks for, it seems the music is so synced up to the action.
Well, there's a fun superstition, which is that when I get a call saying, oh, so-and-so wants to do their movie, they're going into production, the director's always wanted to use you, and, they're going off to shoot the movie, we just want to make sure you're available, in 3 months. Mm-hmm. I know that I will not be scoring that picture.
Okay.
Because by the time he shot the movie, uh-huh. and he says, who's going to do the movie? Oh, Stuart. Oh, well, there's this, it's just a superstition. I know that's one movie that I will not be scoring.
Okay.
So I usually get the films when they're finished.
Mm-hmm.
And the glorious progress of a film, it starts off with pre-production, which is the script, and anything is possible, and it's all been great. We're gonna have Meryl Streep and Tom Cruise, and mm-hmm. then the reality hits and they actually shoot the movie, and they didn't get the shot the director wanted necessarily, and by the time I see the movie, the thing is rotting on the slab, and they call the composer in last mm-hmm. to see what can be done about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of my time as a composer is fixing problems that they had when they made the movie. That you just don't get the fact that the guy's lying when he tells the girl, I love you.
Right.
I have to put in the bad chord.
Right, okay.
And the music, so the film's done by the time I see it.
Yeah.
And the director tells me, here in this scene, what I need emotionally is happy or sad, or happy sad, or sad happy,
mm-hmm.
Or whatever, the complex array of emotions. And he needs that help here. Or sometimes it's a piece of information, such as the guy's lying.
Mm-hmm.
And the woman he's saying that to, we need to believe that she believes him and she's gazing adoring into his eyes. But the audience needs to know that he's a lying scumbag.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's the composer's job. Because everything else on the picture, the guy's real handsome. The scene is a beautiful moonlit night. She's a beautiful woman looking adoringly into his eyes. I mean, everything else, all the other information that the audience gets, the audience needs to know something that isn't on the screen, which is that he's a lying scumbag. And so that's the role that music plays.
And it sounds like you have a lot of fun doing that. I know you've been working on
it. I don't actually do it anymore.
Well, what about Ben-Hur?
Now, Ben-Hur is an entirely different...
Because you're going back to an old print of that that you've been working on. And
That's a whole different kettle of
fish.
What that is there's music that I wrote for an arena production of Ben-Hur.
Mm-hmm.
Big orchestral score. They staged it in arenas. They did the whole thing there. And then when that did its course over like a 2-year period, I still had this music, wanted to play concerts.
Mm-hmm.
And I found this 1925 black and white silent version of Ben-Hur, which is much bigger than the Charlton Heston.
Mm-hmm.
It was huge. Not a cast of thousands, a cast of tens of thousands.
Mm-hmm.
And they really did have giant warships crashing into each other in flames. And just unbelievable, huge, stupendously monumental production. And the best thing about it, of all, is that it's silent.
Mm-hmm.
Catnip for a composer. And so I can completely fill it up. When I score a film, I'm dodging dialogue, dodging sound effects, and the music is just one...
But this is wide open.
One element in a complex, tapestry. But here... And the other thing is that the people who made the film are long gone.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me a long time to get permission from Warner Brothers, but finally, after a couple of years of working my way through, I finally got the green light and was able to get this 80-year-old celluloid and out of deep freeze.
So cool.
It took about 10 days to defrost it and telecine it. The last time it had been out of the cans was... in the 60s when they shot it to video, which is a really ugly medium.
Yeah.
And so this venerable old lady out of the vault defrosted, and they telecined it, and I got an incredible result. And then I had to spend the next year curating it, mm-hmm. removing the dust and scratches, and the blacks had faded to gray, and so I had to go in there and use filters to re-blacken the blacks, but not too much. So it was a job of curation. And I had this score, and I cut this 2-hour, 40-minute movie down to 90 minutes, a workable 90 minutes. So the upshot is that I show up with an orchestra, the Chicago Symphony or wherever, and they run the big movie, and there's a big orchestra on the stage and me banging on my drums.
I want to ask you one last question before we wrap this up, and I really appreciate your time. so, and this one's a little personal. So, Stuart Copeland, go back with me 34 years.
34 years. Specifically.
1981, MTV goes on the air. Ghost in the Machine comes out. I'm 12 years old. And I saw the video for Every Little Thing She Does Is Magic, and it was my favorite video at the time. And I immediately went out and bought my first album, which was Ghost in the Machine.
Oh, shucks.
And then bought, of course, the first three Police albums after that. But, you know, still that video. I love that video. And why I loved it so much when I was a kid, the three of you look like you were having just so much fun in the studio, on the bus, joking around. And it seemed like this just really genuine, like you guys were having such a good time. Can you tell me just a little bit about the shooting of that video? I mean, were you guys having that good of a time?
Well, we actually were having a good time shooting the video because that was a momentary respite from the hell of our recording process.
You were in the Caribbean, right?
Where yes,
you
were, we were. Recording? We were on an island, actually, that's been destroyed by a volcano. It's not there anymore.
Wow, okay.
The studio is under, you know, 10 feet of ash.
Yeah.
But the recording Police albums was very uncomfortable. It was not a comfortable experience. We challenged each other extremely. And I think we're all happy with the result,
mm-hmm.
but we beat each other up pretty severely to get that result. And shooting the video, we didn't have to worry about making music. All we had to do was bounce around looking handsome, you know, and when you're 30, that's a lot easier than it is now. That's for sure. And so, yes, that was genuine joy you saw on the screen.
Nice.
It is fun to be out there in the Caribbean. It was this paradise island. But it was actually, we were all in emotional hell driving each other berserk.
So it was a real release.
We've laughed about it since, of course.
Very cool. Stuart Copeland, thank you so much for coming on Art of the Matter. It's a real pleasure.
Well, thanks for having me.
Travis DiNicola with musician Stuart Copeland, best known for his work as the drummer for The Police, as well as for many movie soundtracks. You can find out more about Copeland at stuartcopeland.net, StuartCopeland.net. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
Don't forget the sunscreen this weekend because we're going to be outdoors.
That's right. It is time for the Broad Ripple Art Fair, which is really kind of the kickoff of the summer art season.
Indeed it is. And we'll tell you a little bit more about that and other things you can do on that calendar we call
What'll We Do? Well, speaking of summer, it's not summer until you start playing croquet.
The Wicked World of Croquet? Is it that time?
Yes, it's coming up very soon.
I wondered why you were dressed all in white.
Benjamin Harrison Presidential Site, Wicked World of Croquet event, 21st year for this competition. It is coming up on May 30th, and you can still register your team. Teams are of two people, and there's both a competitive and a leisure bracket.
Hmm.
And by registering, you also you can eat and drink and hang out and wear your whites and play croquet all day. It is a great event, and I will be there, of course, trying to...
I was going
to
say, I feel like I should warn people if they're going to play.
I'm in the competitive
bracket. Play against you.
Yeah, well,
you're like cutthroat croquet player.
Yeah, because croquet is a contact sport.
Okay.
Of course, you can find out more at the Benjamin Harrison Presidential website, bhpsite.org, and register your team now. Yes.
Right now.
It's time.
Right now. Hey, Broad Ripple Art Fair is this weekend. There's a preview party on Friday night. If you're hearing us on Thursday night, you can still take advantage of that. If you're hearing us on Saturday morning, don't worry. You have plenty of hours. You can still enjoy the Broad Ripple Art Fair on the grounds near the Indianapolis Art Center at Optimist Opti Park at 67th Street and College Avenue. There's free parking and a shuttle, actually multiple shuttles, from Glendale Town Center parking lot. That's the one slightly east of Glendale Shopping Mall. And there are more than 225 artists and craftspeople who will be in the fair this year. It takes practically the whole year to put it on, seriously juried artists, but also all kinds of food, kids' activities, Sun King beer, live music demonstrations, and some of the most popular things to do there are you can actually go in the Broad Ripple Art Center and peek in on classes in progress or demonstrations in progress like the glass blowing workshop.
Yeah, that's always a cool one to see.
Love that.
Very fun stuff. Yeah, Broad Ripple Art Fair is always such a great weekend. Hey, something else going on this weekend. The Indiana Ballet Conservatory is presenting La Fille Mal Gardée, or The Wayward Daughter, a comic ballet, and they are doing that on Saturday at 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. at the Toby Theater at the IMA.
So, If you've listened to us for a while, you probably have figured out that we have stretched the definition of arts to include culinary and gustatory arts.
Oh, of course.
So
what?
I just want to bring to your attention that you could just wait and go to the Broad Ripple Art Fair on Sunday, and on Saturday afternoon at 2, go to the City Market for the Midwest Sour and Wild and Funk Fest. What is that? Well, it's a celebration of sour beers, one of my favorite categories. You can find out more at uplandbeer.com, which is a chief organizer. So that's this Saturday at 2 o'clock at the City Market. And they have designated driver tickets.
Oh, very cool. Hey, another art festival going on is the Summer Festival of the Arts at IU. And that is actually kicking off this weekend and then continues off and on throughout the summer with a whole bunch of different events. But they are having the Kinsey Institute Juried Art Show that is opening up this weekend at the Grunewald Gallery of Art. And then lots and lots of other events that are coming up throughout the whole summer with authors and films and poetry and writers and exhibits and lots of very cool stuff. Definitely worth checking out if you're planning to go down to Bloomington sometime.
Fabulous. This Saturday from 9 to noon at Garfield Park, the annual Garfield Park Master Gardeners Plant Sale. Annuals and perennials, a great opportunity to purchase some healthy plants at reasonable prices and a chance to talk to gardeners about your garden challenges and garden questions. Garfield Park this Saturday, 9 to noon.
That sounds delightful. Mm-hmm. Lots of good summer things to do.
It is, yeah.
This weekend. So, well, you can always learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide website, or listen to us
on that calendar we call
What Will We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
For nearly three decades, Kirk Trevor has been on the podium wherever the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra appeared. Now he's leaving the ICO for New Horizons. Maestro Trevor stopped in recently to share some reflections on what makes the ICO strong, why he loves having positions at multiple orchestras, and what inspired him to a conducting career at the tender age of 8.
I realize this is going to test your memory because you've been with the ICO for so long, but do you remember how you first became aware of the orchestra?
Yeah, it was actually through my former roommate from London back in 1970, Sherban Lupu, who was the concertmaster of the ICO at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And Sherban and I had lived together for 2 years in London when he was preparing for the Carl Flesch competition. And then I came to America, and he later came to America to teach at the University of Illinois. And we'd kind of lost touch for maybe 10 years, and then reacquainted ourselves with each other maybe 5 years before this position came open. And then the search process, I guess, had started, and Sherban called me and said, you know, would you be interested? And then I said, I really don't know because I'm just starting in Knoxville. And then I think the process had started, and then another one of my great friends, David Ott, called and said, Kirk, you really need to come down here and take a look at this situation, because he felt that there was enormous potential, and David was somebody who I was very close to at the time. And so I said, okay, I'll throw my hat into the ring, and I was invited to, I think I was the last candidate, actually. It was in March 88. And I remember the program included a solo from Dan Gosling. Dan Gosling played a Sammartini trumpet concerto or Frescatini or one of those. And I did Haydn 102 and a J.C. Bach symphony with the orchestra. And it was at, I think it was at the Museum of Art back in those
mm-hmm,
days.
Mm-hmm.
And what's now the Toby, I think,
right,
in that room. And I was impressed with the orchestra. I was impressed by their camaraderie and great enthusiasm for music making and quality of music making at the time. You know, we were all in our 30s in those days. I mean, it was like...
Boundless energy.
Boundless energy. I mean, that's one of the things I always reflect back on, you know, is that now so many of us are still together, but we're not 30 anymore. You know, we're a little older than that.
You're more mature.
And so I often wonder what changed in the 27 years that I've been here. And, you know, as with all of us, we still think of ourselves as 30-year-old, you know, young whippersnappers and still think of ourselves with, you know, our original hair and all of those kind of things. And I look around, you know, and we've all grown up together. And I think that's part of the interesting process of growing old together as musicians in an ensemble like the ICO. We've all, our music making has matured. We now do things, play with more maturity. We know the ropes much better.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, some things have probably gone a little, you know, from our boundless energy to, you know, controlled energy.
Which isn't necessarily bad.
It's not necessarily bad. I mean, I think that one of the, you know, a discussion for later is what's the difference between, shall we say, you know, you have a youth orchestra, let's say everybody under 20. You have young orchestras that are starting out, you know, usually in New York, all of these orchestras that try to get together, the 20 to 30 group,
mm-hmm.
and those orchestras. And then what I call the mature orchestra, the Berlin Philharmonic, the Indianapolis Symphony, and now the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra. We have quite a number of new young players in the orchestra, but the stakeholders are obviously elder statesmen, and we kind of look at how orchestras sound, what's the difference between the sound of those different kinds of groups. And obviously, as a conductor, would a, you know, 20-year-old conductor in front of a 50-year-old orchestra sound different than a 50-year-old conductor in front? You know, I think those are kind of difficult questions to answer, but I have always been a very physical conductor. I've always been, you know, highly energetic in the podium, and I believe music is a physical art. So, yeah, when I think back on 27 years ago when Sherbaum and David and early pictures of that were taken at the Butler Fountain.
Yeah, I remember those.
And I mean, it's been an exciting journey. It's been an exciting journey, but...
Aren't you only the second conductor of the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra?
Yeah, I'm the second music director, David Ernest and myself.
Yeah, and you have, you know, it's you're being very modest. I think you need to take some responsibility and some credit for keeping... I mean, you have new, fresh, young players, and people sometimes get married and move away or move away for other jobs, but you have a pretty big core that has been with the orchestra, in some cases all 30, 31 seasons now.
Yeah, indeed. I think there are...
lean times.
I think there are probably 10 to 12 original charter members, we call them charter members.
So that's almost half.
Yeah.
Or more than half.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a third, I think. Yes, I mean, it's a good number of people that have just felt that this orchestra was their life and their center of their lives.
Yeah.
And they bring to it a great, you know, wisdom and solidity, the glue that holds the group together sometimes.
Yeah.
So
you yourself came to conducting, weren't you like 8 when you decided you wanted to study conducting?
7.
Don't make
me so old.
Please. Well, yes. Somewhere along the line, you picked up the cello, too, which came first.
I was 11 when I picked up the cello.
And why? So what led you?
Well, I was a pianist when I was very young.
Okay.
Like when I was 3 or 4, I was a pianist. And
Because you were drawn to it, or your parents wanted you to be a musician, or where'd that come from?
Well, I was actually an orphan, and my adopted parents adopted me when I was 6. And in the orphanage I was in had a piano. You know, I think they all have one, and I was kind of one of the troublemakers who just always ran down and played the piano at 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, you know, for hours on end, and woke up the whole the whole house. And so I became well known, I think, in the administrative circles of child care, of it being this kind of young kid who always wanted to play the piano and picked out tunes by ear and obviously showed some musical talent. And my adopted parents, my mother had some had great musical love, and so when the adoption process went through, kind of, I negotiated a deal. You know, you can adopt me if you buy me a piano. And so that actually took place. And so the piano came in. I signed the papers. And, you know, they got me. I got my piano.
Well played.
And
that's a skill set that I suspect has served you well over your adult career.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, then I started taking piano lessons and part of the whole British training of music training was to incorporate ear training and conducting as part of learning to play the piano, and the conducting part was the only part I was interested in. I mean, I was a pretty good pianist, I have to say, but I always wanted to spend more time on the conducting training part. And so when I was 7, I started making it known that conducting was the thing I really wanted to do. And then when I was 11, I went to my high school and took up the cello, because I knew that in order to become a conductor, I needed to learn all of the orchestral literature, and I would need to play an orchestral instrument. And so the school had a school orchestra, and I chose the cello only because it was the last instrument available after I came. I was a big athlete back in those days. I was a tennis player and field hockey player, and field hockey practices were the same night as come try out a different instrument night. So by the time I came off of the field hockey field, the only instrument left in the music room was a cello. So that was the one I took home. And I had a bicycle in those days with a rack on the front where I did my paper round. So there was this big rack which usually held all of the paper bag, the bag that had all of the 90 papers in it. And that was now the rack that held the cello.
Oh, my gosh.
And my mother always tells this story of I was a little late coming home that day, and she saw this vehicle, this cello, driving towards her, because I was behind the cello. The cello was standing up in the rack, and all she could see was a cello on a bicycle cello riding towards her. So, that was the cello, and then that just led to a lot of other conducting opportunities, simply because I was kind of the known child prodigy, so to speak, in the town. And by the time I was 15, I was conducting the town orchestra and my youth orchestras. And the piece that we just played in the April concert at the Schott, The Siegfried Idyll, was probably my first kind of signature tune, shall we say. I conducted Siegfried Idyll everywhere, with youth orchestras, with city orchestras, because you only needed 17 players. And so I was kind of running around at 13, 14, 15, trying to get groups of people together to play this piece. So
but it's got a lot of challenge, too. It may only have 16, 17 players, but the dynamics are quite the challenge right there.
Yeah, and of course, being a young, at 14, 15, conducting other 14, 15, 16-year-olds, we were all in this kind of big fun thing together, and they enjoyed having, one of their own conducting rather than the famous guy on the podium, you know, in front of them, our youth orchestra conductor. And so I've always promoted and believed in developing young conductors, from the earliest age, and support young conductors.
And you've done that all over the world, too.
I teach conducting all over the world. I've been fortunate enough to have established myself as a conducting teacher, because I'm a technique guru, and I have a system that helps young conductors complement their natural musical instincts. I think that the thing about conducting is, look, if you want to conduct, we assume you're going to be musical. I mean, you wouldn't want to conduct unless you had something to say. I always tell people, the only reason to conduct is because you have something to say, and that you don't like what other people say about it. Basically, my way of teaching conductors how to conduct is find a recording you hate so that you have an opinion about what to do differently.
Brilliant.
And that is, the way that conductors develop. I don't like this bar, and you have to find out why you don't like it and how you would do it differently, and then you establish your own interpretation and independence of musical thinking. So I think that supporting young conductors, as I was very fortunate to have a youth orchestra conductor from age 12 who immediately saw my enthusiasm. You know, I was a teacher's pet kind of thing, conductor's pet. But, you know, I think eventually other kids got over the thing about Kirk's, the conductor's pet, because, you know, I got on the podium and actually could do the job. And so that then became a kind of certain admiration society amongst my peers, because I could, you know, they didn't need to have Mr. Turton conducting them all the time. You know, Kirk can do this. So I think that was exciting for all of us. It was a great time in my life and many of their lives. I mean, some of them who were still in touch with each other 50 years later.
Sharon Gamble with Kirk Trevor, about to retire music director of the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra. You can hear Maestro Trevor with the ICO at this Saturday night's 7:30 performance at the Schratt Center for the Arts, with Mendelssohn, Paganini, and Dafala on the program, and soloist Bella Ristova. Learn more and get your tickets at icomusic.org. Again, icomusic.org. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll get to cruise through the Dream Cars exhibit at the IMA.
I'll find out about a new anthology of women writers called Every Father's Daughter.
And I'll find out about a man who was instrumental in the growth of the aerospace industry and the aeronautical industry in Indiana. His name is Cap Cornish, and I'll interview an author of a book about him. And we'll have that arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.